Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tonight, President Trump will make an announcement likely to alter the course of the country for the next several generations. At 9 tonight, the president will announce his choice to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Although Kennedy was a conservative, he often sided with liberals on the court and did so in history-making ways. Trump, meanwhile, has promised to nominate a conservative in the mold of Neil Gorsuch, his previous appointment. Unless something happens in Congress, this will solidify conservative control of the court for generations and calls into question the future of abortion rights and gay marriage, among myriad other issues. So what will the post-Kennedy court look like? What are the implications of a solidly conservative majority on settled law and on future cases that may come before the court? Here to talk about that and more is Dr. John Schmier, associate professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
He is in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone are Guy Charles and Martha Ginn. Professor Charles is a professor at Duke University's School of Law and founding director of the Duke Center on Law, Race, and Politics. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Dr. Ginn is professor of political science and public administration at Augusta University in Augusta, Georgia, where she is also an associate dean and an expert on public opinion of the judiciary. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
So we have had this conservative majority on the court for quite a while now. So why does this appointment seem to carry so much weight, Dr. Schmier?
So Anthony Kennedy is what we would call a swing justice. He pretty much controls the outcome.
Has he always been that?
On some issues, yes. Some issues it was Sandra Day O'Connor until 2005 when she retired.
Okay.
But certainly since then, she has been the... He has been the swing voter on all but a small handful of issues, like the Affordable Care Act, where it was actually Chief Justice Roberts.
So since this appointment occurred, or this opening occurred, we've heard about the impact, the potential impact of this appointment on the future of abortion, on the future of gay rights, the future of health care, maybe not the Affordable Care Act per se, but whatever may happen after the Affordable Care Act. What other issues stand in the balance here?
So one that's become a major cause for both President Trump and the Republican Party establishment is deference to the bureaucracy. As part of this attack on the deep state, the modern Republican Party is going after something called Chevron deference, this idea that judges are supposed to defer to bureaucratic interpretations of the law because the bureaucrats are the substantive experts and the judges are usually not. Since the bureaucrats are, you know, often make left-leaning decisions, that's at least one reason why the Federalist Society and a lot of conservative judges and the Trump administration are calling for an end to this idea that judges should defer to the bureaucracy.
That's not in the Constitution anywhere, is it? Does it happen in practice regularly? Is that what you're saying? In their opinion, it's happened in practice?
It's a tool that the court came up with in the mid-'80s to help them interpret administrative regulations and statutes. So it's not about constitutional interpretation.
Okay. All right. Justice Kennedy has been viewed as a moderate conservative and a swing vote, as you just said, on certain issues. But the New Republic was quick to point out that Kennedy voted with the conservative majority on Citizens United, which recognized that political spending is a form of free speech. He recently cited in favor of a baker who refused to bake a gay couple a same-sex marriage wedding cake. He voted with conservatives on a case that gutted key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. He upheld a ruling that endorsed cases that endorsed voter ID laws. He sided with the conservative majority on two gun rights cases, and he voted consistently in favor of employers over employees, for corporations over consumers, and against unions. how much more conservative, and I'm not sure which one of you to ask this question of, how much more conservative could a justice be?
Well, I'll be happy to take that one. So I think there are two ways of thinking about these cases, and they fall on different sides of Justice Kennedy's jurisprudence. So there are some cases on the First Amendment where he's basically a very strong proponent of the First Amendment. So Citizens United is a very good example there. This is a campaign finance case where Justice Kennedy said that corporations have a right under the First Amendment to use money from their general treasury in order to spend on political campaigns. So on First Amendment cases, he's actually a very strong proponent. There are other cases like the Masterpiece cake shop case. So this is a case about whether a person with a religious objection has to bake a cake, a same-sex wedding cake, or on race cases, for example, perhaps the Voting Rights Act case. Though on some cases, he's an open vote. That is, there's a possibility, unlike some other of the conservative justices, there's a possibility that you might be able to get him to come on your side. And even on gay rights, where he has built a jurisprudence and a reputation as the justice who wrote the opinion recognizing same-sex marriage, even there he's used as a person who might be able to put a brake on that doctrine so that it wouldn't go too far. And then there are other cases in which people view him as extremely open in possibility of persuasion, more sometimes siding a little bit more with the left. So even though he has been a consistently conservative justice, the distinction is that there are some cases in which he is more open than the conservative justices, and there are some cases in which you might view him as siding with the justices on the left side, such as the gay marriage cases. And I think that's one of the reasons why people view that there's going to be a shift on the court, because the next justice is not likely to be as open as Justice Kennedy, even though that justice is likely to be at least as conservative.
This is where people who don't follow the court and are not lawyers sometimes have a difficulty understanding. When you say he was more open to judging things on the other side, other than the conservative side of the scale, why? Is it strictly based on the law, or is it based on public opinion? Is it based on his own personal opinion? Why would he be more open to that? And why, if he's open to it, wouldn't somebody else who is either conservative or liberal be likely to be able to be persuaded to the other side?
That's a great question. So one is to think about the fact that when you're dealing with cases that are getting to the Supreme Court, those are the toughest cases that we have in constitutional law, which means that there are actually reasonable ways of thinking about how the Constitution views these problems. That for a lot of cases, those cases are pretty simple. They're pretty easy. There are very clear answers. But there are some cases in which there aren't clear answers. There are some cases in which the constitutional doctrine, the constitutional history, the text is open-ended, and so it's quite debatable. So it really does depend upon what your judicial philosophy is. What is the way in which you think about the Constitution and the way in which you look at the world? Some judicial philosophies will take you in one direction as opposed to another. Some judicial philosophies might lead you in the direction on the right on some cases, but a direction on the left on other cases. So it's not a matter of what the judge's individual opinion, and it's certainly not a matter of simply the court looking at public opinion. Those might play a role. Certainly, they might play a role at the margins. But it does matter what your judicial philosophy is, and obviously different judges have different ways of thinking about the Constitution, all of which are valid, but in the hard cases, they're not going to take you in the same direction with respect to the conclusion.
Dr. Schmier.
I would actually argue, I agree with almost everything that Professor Charles said, that that they're hard cases and the judges have different judicial philosophies. But, and maybe this is my perspective as a political scientist, but there's a lot of evidence that suggests that the judges are actually pretty ideological. Mm. It's hard to say whether the ideology causes them to develop a particular judicial philosophy or not. But I think if you look at Justice Kennedy, there are some clear pieces of evidence that he can be ideological and partisan in ways that aren't necessarily consistent with his judicial philosophy. Of course, the classic example of that is Bush versus Gore, which was, from a legal perspective, a very liberal decision, but had a very partisan outcome. Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, I think, are other examples of judges who, you know, have a judicial philosophy that tended to lead to a conservative outcome, but they often have very conservative outcomes that are against their judicial philosophy.
Dr. Ginn, you're one of your areas of expertise is public opinion about the court system, and I'm going to ask you some questions about that later in the program. But it just occurred to me that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 3 million votes. The president is in office because of the Electoral College. And he, as the president, as any president, has the right to move the court to his side of the aisle. So if the court moves to a more conservative position, is that going against what most people in the country want?
Well, I think, you know, you kind of have to unpack several things in this question that you're asking. And the idea that they're definitely going to move in a more conservative direction, I think, is debatable. Going back to what Dr. Shamir was talking about with the, you know, we as political scientists tend to look at the justices ideologically. When you look at them, you know, on a spatial continuum from left to right, you know, Kennedy is definitely, you know, in the center, but Roberts isn't very far to the right of him. And so if you appoint someone who's more conservative than Kennedy, then yes, they're going to probably be to the right of Roberts, but then Roberts might actually shift more to the left. And so, or the continuum itself is going to shift a little bit to the right. But I think that I really kind of think that the Kennedy nomination is important, or the replacement for Kennedy is important, but I don't think it's going to be this seismic shift that everyone right. is anticipating. Would you have, you know, say Justice Ginsburg or Justice Breyer retiring? And I do think when you talk about, you know, public opinion of the judiciary, I think Roberts is concerned about his legacy on the court, and I think he will possibly moderate some so that he doesn't allow the court to be deemed overtly political and, you know, another victory for the Trump administration.
And Justice Kennedy surprised conservatives with several of his decisions over the years. Is there anything to say, whether you have a judicial philosophy that is well known or that emerges in the course of congressional hearings or that emerges in the vetting process at the White House for the appointments to figure out which nominee they want to put up to the Congress? Is it likely that somebody else might also surprise people, even though they're conservative?
So there's a fairly long history, particularly over the last 50 years, of Republican nominees frustrating Republicans once thrown the court. Going back to the 50s with Eisenhower appointees like Brennan and Warren, then Blackmun in the 70s. Stevens in the 70s, Souter in the 90s.
The same does not happen on the left?
Not as much.
Why not? Why not?
That's a good question. One argument that there are certain issues that take a toll, like death penalty cases, that tend to, you know, that was one argument about Blackmun and what moved him to the left. Sometimes it's personality. It's hard to say. But what we do know is since the 80s, Republicans have been very concerned about this. And so one of the things they did was help create the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society vets the nominees in the same way that the American Bar Association used to do. So this list of 25 that Trump is picking from, they've all been vetted by the Federalist Society. These are all folks that were part of the Federalist Society. The likelihood of them being a sheep in wolf's clothing or vice versa is nil, I think.
So when we come back, we'll talk about process and we'll talk about the Federalist Society. Who are these people? We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Supreme Court tonight at 9. The president will make his announcement about who he wishes the Congress to take a look at to be the next justice on the Supreme Court to replace the retiring Anthony Kennedy. John Schmier is here. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Guy Charles, Professor and Founding Director of the Duke University School of Law, Center for Law, Race, and Politics. And Dr. Martha Ginn, Associate Professor of Political Science at Augusta University, are all with us. Dr. Schmier just mentioned the Federalist Society. Martha Ginn, who are they?
The Federalist Society, they're an interest group that essentially wrote the list of or identified the list of potential nominees for President Trump when he was candidate Trump. And while he is, you know, the ultimate decider of which of those nominees to pick, he hasn't gone off that list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other people are concerned about that because typically the list would originate with the administration itself with help from, you know, other members of the administration and then maybe run it through the American Bar Association, et cetera. But to let the Federalist Society, which is clearly a conservative interest group with, you know, very clear policy goals, be the author and originator of the list tends to concern many voters.
This whole process is a little muddied because Senator Mitch McConnell refused to hold hearings on President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the court, a seat later taken by Neil Gorsuch under President Trump. And the reason given at the time was that it was a presidential election year, and McConnell said Congress should wait for the outcome of that election before making a decision on a new justice. Well, this is also an election year, and Democrats who were against that argument 2 years ago are now trying to invoke it. McConnell, of course, has changed his tune on this, and he says that the Senate will confirm a nominee before the fall election. Is there any way to stop this, Guy Charles?
No, I don't think there's a way to stop this. The Republicans hold the decisive votes in the Senate. They're the majority. I think the Democrats will and can complain. But this is the problem when you're in the minority, is that you really can't, especially on Supreme Court nominations, you really can't stop the majority. So I don't think there's anything that can be done. Mitch McConnell played the politics, and he played them extremely well. The distinction that he's making between, say, an election year in which the presidential election year versus non-presidential election year, those are political distinctions, and this is purely the politics at work. So I don't think there's anything that the Democrats can do. They're attempting to put as much public opinion pressure as they possibly can, especially on the senators who are in vulnerable states. But I think that's about as much as can be done, and I don't think it's going to stop what seems to be the president getting his wish on whoever his nominee is going to be, getting that person confirmed through the Senate.
Somebody somewhere, at some headline I read this morning, and I don't know where I read it because we are inundated by news, suggests that the Democrats ought to sue, saying that Mitch McConnell's breaking his own rule here. I'm not sure who you would sue. Is that even within the realm of possibility?
No.
Okay, no. Just check.
Sometimes lawyers make bad arguments, and that's a very good example of that is an op-ed in The Hill.
Okay,
and that's a good example of a bad argument by a lawyer.
Okay, according to all accounts, both the Conservative Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society have recommended these judges, as we talked about, to the Trump administration, and they did this a long time ago. This list of 20 or 25 judges. They've been vetting these people for months. News reports have put forth several potential front runners, among them Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Raymond Kethledge, and one emerged over the weekend, Thomas Hardiman. Let's talk about these people. They're all conservatives. Are they all cut from the same cloth? Dr. Ginn.
No. I mean, yes and no. I mean, they're all Court of Appeals judges, which, you know, is rare to have all the front runners have the same sort of background, although they have varying degrees of experience there. Particularly Barrett is a recent appointee, and, you know, that could actually be very relevant because you just had a confirmation hearing, which was a bit contentious, but then you have three moderate Democrats who are up for re-election who voted for her within the past year. So the question is, well, what's changed now? Why would you not still vote for her if you voted for her for the Court of Appeals? I think some will be easier road to confirmation than others. I think Barrett probably would be a difficult one for Trump, just because, again, going back to some of the comments she made at her Court of Appeals confirmation hearing, but she is attractive because
what did she say? I know that she was challenged on her ability to render a decision faithful to the law in certain areas, given her deep religious convictions. Is that where she ran into trouble?
Mainly, and the questions from, you know, Senator Feinstein regarding that. And then there's also a couple law review articles that she has where she suggests that maybe precedent isn't sacrosanct, and, you know, coupling those ideas together. So you have a very devout Catholic who has been on the record saying that precedent isn't sacrosanct. That tends to resonate with people who want to overturn Roe v. Wade. The other sort of wild card about her, again, is she's only been on the court for 8 months, so there's not a long paper trail to know how she would actually rule on things, and that could cut both ways, to be honest. But she's also very young. She's only 46 years old, so if she was appointed, you know, she's sort of like Clarence Thomas. She's going to be on there for decades. So if she is what, you know, the conservatives want her to be, she will have a long-lasting legacy on there. Then someone like Hardiman, who I mentioned came out this weekend as a possible, he was actually a contender for the Gorsuch nomination. He served with President Trump's sister. He has this, you know, great narrative, first-generation college student, drove a taxi cab to pay for law school, et cetera. I think he would probably be a little bit easier of a confirmation than maybe Barrett would be. But I think that he, again, is going to be a bit of a wild card. You know, the political scientists who try to estimate where people would fall on this ideological spectrum thinks he is actually in between Kennedy and Roberts. So it would definitely be a more even swap than, say, someone like Kavanaugh would be.
Couple of things. First, a lot of people don't realize this, but President Trump's sister, Marianne Trump Barry, was a Court of Appeals judge on the Third Circuit. And apparently she actually recommended Hardiman for, you know, during the Gorsuch nomination. He was actually the second choice.
Why is he just now emerging then?
Okay, this is a little bit complicated. It's inside baseball, but
this whole thing is complicated.
Right.
Are you kidding?
So Kavanaugh is the mainstream Republican poster child. And Donald McGahn, the White House counsel, whose job it is essentially to recommend nominees and vet the nominees for the president, he's apparently been enamored of Kavanaugh for actually months now. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, was the only choice basically emerging out of the White House counsel's office. But there are some fears, even though he's Roman Catholic and he's been conservative, he's not conservative enough on the key issue, abortion, for at least Christian conservatives. At the same time, Barrett emerges just as a hero because of the one quote from Feinstein during her confirmation last year. So then you have the two sides of the party warring just in the last week over which of the nominees. And so then Kethledge emerges as the sort of, okay, he's, you know, Goldilocks, or he's Baby Bear. He's just right. He's sort of in the middle. President Trump doesn't like him, apparently, when they interviewed. He thought he was boring. And so then they needed a fourth candidate. They go back to Hardiman.
Is that a valid criticism, that you're boring?
When I think of the criteria to be a good judge, I usually think of boring as leaning towards, you know, an important criteria. But, you know, somebody like Scalia was definitely not boring, and for a lot of people, he was a great judge.
So the up until this weekend, the three front runners that we kept being told were front runners, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Raymond Kethledge, are all Catholic. I don't know what Thomas Hardiman's faith is, but they were all Catholic. And there were concerns about this on the left because of the Catholic Church's stance against abortion and concerns over their decisions on what may happen in the future with Roe v. Wade. Is this any different than the preconceived notions and concerns about John F. Kennedy's Catholicism?
No.
It's the same issue.
Yeah.
That they can't separate their faith from politics and from the government.
Correct. Interestingly enough, Judge Barrett wrote a Law Review article in the late 90s, I believe, suggesting that Roman Catholic judges should recuse themselves in death penalty cases because the church is also, you know, pretty clearly against the death penalty as well.
In recent years, the nation has become increasingly polarized and increasingly controlled by Republicans and forces on the right. Hundreds of court appointments to lower courts were left vacant during the Obama administration for lack of, I think, congressional approval. Trump has appointed, I believe, a record number of people to those courts for a president this early in his tenure. He also will now have two appointments to the Supreme Court, to his credit. Even under less polarized circumstances, is it safe to say, Guy, that the real permanent power is with the judicial branch?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is something that I think the Republicans have institutionally understood for a very long time. They have taken the courts quite seriously. They have taken judicial appointments very seriously. They have taken to stocking the courts, thinking about particular individuals, making sure that those folks get experience, whether it is at the lower court level or at the state Supreme Court. So you have one party who has thought about those issues and who sees the power of the courts, the power of the federal courts in particular, and of course the Supreme Court. We do have three branches, and so the courts really do matter. They frame the types of issues that the political process has to address and deal with. And so the ability to narrow the scope of those issues, so for example, earlier there was a mention of Chevron deference and the administrative state. Part of what's interesting about the administrative state is that you can't move the law if the bureaucrats are going, especially the line bureaucrats, are going to have the same opinion over and over and over again for many, many years. And so you need to get rid of that deference that the courts give to them in order to move the law in the direction that you want to move them in. And I think the Republican Party understands this in a way that I don't know that the Democratic Party takes the courts as seriously. And this is a complaint that people had under the Obama administration, that particularly for his first 2 years, Obama was too slow to move on the courts and on judicial appointments. And this is not something that you've seen historically with the Republicans, particularly with the rise of the Federalist Society and their recognition that in order to move public policy, you can't ignore the courts.
So I think another, you know, point that comes from what is an excellent point is the importance of this nomination for the 2018 elections. So it's, yes, Professor Charles said, it's basically a fait accompli. Whoever the nominee is, unless there's some incredible surprise that hasn't been vetted yet, they're going to be confirmed. So what we're going to see is political theater, and the question is, you know, can the Democrats or the Republicans use this to energize their base in a midterm election to get a bigger turnout when it comes to both the House and the Senate? And because this is an issue, judicial appointments, that's so much that the Republicans, not only are they more organized about, but they care more intensely about, you know, they're likely to win the turnout war.
For which party is this the trickier road to walk? If you are trying to play to the base of your party, and this is going to happen prior to a midterm election, which party has to be more careful about how they position what's happening in Congress with this appointment?
So the Democrats, mainly.
Yeah, I agree.
They have more Senate seats at stake, and there are more of them in several of them are in red states, states that voted for Trump.
Right. So what do they have to say, Dr. Ginn?
Well, I think I agree completely with John. I mean, there's, you know, almost, you know, 2.5 times more Democrats up for reelection. 10 of them are in states that Trump won. And so I think that the Democrats have to be very careful trying to force their senators to stay lockstep against any Trump nominee, because if they say you have Joe Donnelly from Indiana, and again, like he voted to confirm Barrett for the Court of Appeals. If she's the nominee and he votes against her, that's going to leave him wide open to a very strong, you know, challenger in the midterm election. And there's a handful of those that it's very concerning for. And so I almost feel as like the Democrats need to sort of say, you know, you get a pass on this one, because we realize that it would be even worse for us to lose your seat. Because, again, the reality is, you know, you may have other retirements in the next 2 years of the Trump administration. And, you know, if you replace one of the more liberal-leaning judges, then you definitely have that seismic shift that we were talking about previously.
I want to come back to that process in a second. Did you want to chime in on this, Guy?
Yeah, just one very brief point on that excellent point. If I may just add one more part, which is that the Democrats are also internally increasingly divided between those on the left who really want the rank and file and the Democratic leadership to take on the Trump administration, particularly around an issue like this one, where they believe that a number of important precedents, such as Roe v. Wade, are going to be at stake. And then the proceduralists of the party who are trying to think about the difficult votes that some of their members might have to take. And so there's an additional peril here for the Democratic Party in terms of how it's going to navigate these sets of questions.
I have about 10 seconds. Is that really any different than the divide in the Republican Party? Anybody want to take it?
Me?
Yeah. 10 seconds.
I think there's a similar divide on the Republican Party, but I don't think it's as acute, quite frankly. I know you only have 10 seconds, and we can return to this when you come back.
Okay, well, we'll do that. That's Professor Guy Charles, Professor Duke University School of Law. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
What is the Charlotte music scene? Seriously, what is it? Where is it? How can we find it? WFAE is working on a new series of stories about the rockers, singers, and artists who helped shape the Queen City's soundscape. Submit your story now on wfae.org/cltmusic. Support for this series is provided by Ortho Carolina.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tonight at 9, the president will make his announcement about who he's going to nominate to the Supreme Court. We'll cover that live for you here on WFAE, and we're having a discussion about what might happen next with Dr. John Schmier, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Martha Ginn, Associate Professor of Political Science at Augusta University, and Professor Guy Charles, the founding director of the Duke Center for Law, Race, and Politics. And we were talking just before the break about the divide that you were talking about, Dr. Charles, in the Democratic Party and the fine line they have to walk here. But there's also a divide in the Republican Party between the extreme right and the moderate center of the Republican Party. Is there really any difference?
You know, I think it is different. I mean, I think the Republicans are in the majority, and so that does matter. I also think that they're in pole position here. That is, they're getting a chance to shape the Supreme Court. And really, almost anybody that they're considering will at least maintain the position that Justice Kennedy holds on the court, and more than likely will shift the court slightly even to the right. And so I think for them, for the Republican Party, that where they seem to be much more unified on these questions than the Democratic Party is, as the out party, I think the divide is certainly not as great. And so I think the stakes for them are not quite as high. It seems when you're listening to the Democrats and you're listening to the Democratic base, it seems much more existential for them than it does for the Republicans.
But the divide
I would agree, but I would say that it's going to depend on who the nominee is, too. So if President Trump does decide to nominate Judge Barrett, I think you're going to see a lot of pressure on your moderate GOP senators with regard to the Roe v. Wade precedent, particularly Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins.
I was just going to get to this. The majority Republicans hold in the Senate is tiny. They need at least 50 of their 51 senators to vote yes, because Vice President Pence will break any tie. And Lisa Murkowski, and particularly Susan Collins has said quite clearly that if there's any threat to Roe v. Wade, she will vote against this person. Do you think she'll stick to her guns on that?
Well, she also in the same conversation said that she was fine with her votes for Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts, and I believe Samuel Alito, because they had all said that they believed in the importance of precedent. And so she interpreted from that they would vote to uphold Roe versus Wade.
So Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar, who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee and who will be part of this, says that, and this is a quote, "The key is not to give up. We need to make the case to the American people about how the decisions that this court makes every day affect people's lives. Look at the last decade," she says, "where you can go to school, who you can marry, how you can vote, if you can vote. Those are the kinds of decisions they make. And Senate Democratic Leader Charles Schumer frames the debate this way. He says, "Let this be a call to action for Americans from all corners of the country to rise up and speak out." Dr. Martha Ginn, you are an expert on public opinion. Does this really matter? Does it matter what people think about these nominees given Republican control? Would it matter if the tables were turned and Democrats were in control?
Well, I think first, when you talk about public opinion of the judiciary, you have to realize that people are not very well informed about the judiciary. They tend to like the judiciary because they don't know much about it, although it has taken some hits in recent decades, although it seems to be recovering sort of the esteem for the court. I think, as we've talked about several times this morning, Republicans get it better than Democrats that the court is significant, and largely because the party messages that in a more effective way. And so, it really did play an important role in the 2016 presidential election. I think the important thing to think about is the reverse, and that is the role that public opinion plays on the judiciary itself. And again, going back to Roberts and his legacy, et cetera, historically, the courts tend to be more in line with public opinion than perhaps the other branches of government, because they are not supposed to be overtly partisan. And so there are many instances where the court has come out more proactively on certain issues than the elected branches of government. I mean, one is integrating public schools. More recently is the rights of the LGBTQ community. And so when you have conservatives saying, this is going to put the end to that, I don't agree with that. I think that the court looks and sees that, 60% or more of Americans favor these rights, and maybe the expansion of these rights, and I don't see them withdrawing it. I think you could probably say the same thing for Roe as a general precedent. Of course, the court may uphold some restrictions from the states, but they're not going to go so far outside the bounds of what established public opinion is, because they don't have any cover if they do.
But the right has consistently complained about activist judges. Is that a legitimate complaint?
Sure. Both sides have judges that are activist.
Right.
There's a book that was written by a law professor and a political scientist about 10 years ago where they looked at activism and measured activism in all sorts of different ways and found out that, you know, Justice Thomas is probably the biggest activist on the court, that of the top five activists, you know, I think two were from one party and three were from the other. Activism is, you know, you can cloak your decision in a judicial philosophy, but at the end of the day, because these are hard cases, your ideology could come out. There's no court above you that can change your opinion.
One thing we haven't talked about is one thing that Professor Charles is an expert in, and that is gerrymandering. And there have been several cases before the court in just this last year about gerrymandering, particularly with regard to political gerrymandering. We know that racial gerrymandering is illegal. Political gerrymandering is not. And they sent three cases back to the lower courts that dealt with this, one from North Carolina. Is a more conservative court likely to declare political gerrymandering to be unconstitutional, Guy Charles?
I don't think a more conservative court is likely to declare it to be unconstitutional. Probably a more conservative court, if anything, is likely to declare it to be permissible by the political process. The reason why gerrymandering is in question as a constitutional matter here is precisely because Justice Kennedy was open to the idea that political gerrymandering might violate the Constitution. He asked for the court and the litigators to think about what would a constitutional remedy look like. If they could settle on a constitutional remedy, perhaps then they could articulate a constitutional harm and a violation. And that's an indication of, again, Justice Kennedy as a swing justice who's open on certain types of issues, and specifically this one, the political gerrymandering. But the justices to his right, with perhaps the exception of the Chief Justice, who is an institutionalist, as Dr. Gwynne has mentioned, they weren't open. They didn't think that the Constitution addressed the problem of political gerrymandering, that was a problem that is left to the political process. It's the justices on the left, the liberal justices, who thought that the Constitution, either under the First Amendment or under the 14th Amendment, addressed the problem of political gerrymandering. So if one were to guess, a conservative court or a conservative justice is less likely to find that political gerrymandering is unconstitutional, more likely to find that it is permissible as part of the political process.
But couldn't it be argued that the political process has been drastically harmed by political gerrymandering and also by Citizens United, which takes the power and gives it to rich people and corporations? And if you politically gerrymander and make it impossible for one party to really take over from the other party, you've negated any point of having an election.
But
this is essentially the argument that was made to the Chief Justice, and his response in the last set of cases, the case arising out of Wisconsin that you were talking about just a moment ago, his response is, it is not our responsibility to solve that problem. Our responsibility is to decide cases and to address it. Violations of individual rights. So if you show us that your individual right to vote has been violated, then that's something that under the Constitution that we can do something about. We can't do something about a significant political process failure. Right? That was his essential response to that type of an argument. So I completely agree with you. This is something that I write about, that it's hard to have a democratic process if one party targets the other one simply because of the way that people are exercising their political rights in order to minimize political accountability. However, this is not where the court is currently.
Dr. Schmier.
So also keep in mind, not only is the judicial philosophy of most of the conservatives lined up against this idea that political gerrymandering is unconstitutional, right? But don't discount the fact that they're also partisan. And right now, political gerrymandering, at least in the short run, works for conservatives and Republicans in most states. And so they don't want to change that status quo because the status quo works.
So the New York Times...
This is where the law professor in me, though, goes, that might be taking things a little bit too far. And recently, the court took a political gerrymandering case from the that was done by Democrats and one that was done by Republicans. And look, and if you listen to both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy on this, they're very concerned. The court has always been concerned about entering the political gerrymandering because it might be perceived as being partisan, as taking the side of one of the political parties. So I think this is something that the justices will tell you that they're extremely worried about, and that I think they would chafe at the suggestion that that political gerrymandering is constitutional simply because it benefits a side that might be viewed as aligned with their ideological positions.
So the New York Times wrote that this truly will be a Supreme Court confirmation like none before. Do you agree with that, or is that hyperbole?
I think that's hyperbole. Bork is the one like none before, and maybe even ones prior to that. I've said a couple times, I think that both sides are perhaps exaggerating how, you know, the Democrats are exaggerating how terrible it's going to be. The Republicans are, you know, exaggerating how wonderful it's going to be. Yes, Justice Kennedy was the swing voter. Yes, he voted with the left wing of the court on many social issues, but not even consistently. Like if you go to his voting on choice for women. I mean, yes, he was part of sort of the backdoor wheeling and dealing with O'Connor and Casey, but subsequently he wasn't a significant proponent of protecting the rights of women to choose. In fact, he rarely struck down any regulations that the states came up with as an undue burden. It's only recently in the past couple years that he came out and actually went back to protect that right. So, and we mentioned healthcare. That's one of the other things I saw a lot of politicians this weekend on the show saying, you know, this could be so significant for Obamacare. It wasn't Kennedy who upheld Obamacare. It was Chief Justice Roberts.
Much has been made by Democrats of the fact that the president may be involved in some way in the investigation by the Mueller Committee into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, and that the president should not be making an appointment to a court that may have to hear a case against him in the future. But the front runner for Trump's nomination, Brett Kavanaugh, at least he was the front runner on Friday, once argued that President Bill Clinton could be impeached for lying to his staff and misleading the public. Could this be an unexpected gift for those who would like to see the president impeached, given the number of certifiable mistruths that he has told since taking office?
I don't think so. So there's a nice precedent for this. Justice Jackson in the 1950s had worked in the Attorney General's office under FDR, had advocated a decision one way, then when he gets on the court, he writes in a classic opinion, well, I was an attorney arguing the position. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily what I believed in. It's what my client believed in, and this is what the law really is. So Kavanaugh can easily do that. The other thing is Kavanaugh also has a law review article suggesting that the president should not be sued while in office, which is something that, Trump would very much like not to happen.
Right. Depending on the nominee, Guy Charles, do you see a dramatic shift in direction for this court? Do you see the court revisiting or overturning or softening previous decisions by previous courts?
I generally agree with Dr. Ginn, which is on the point that I don't know that we're going to see dramatic moves. But I do think we're likely to see incremental moves. First of all, Chief Justice Roberts, his modus operandi has generally been incrementalism, and eventually leading to a dramatic moment. So you saw that in the voting rights context, where he slowly signaled that there were problems with key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, which many people had long considered to be sacrosanct, that the court wasn't going to touch it, and then eventually overturned some important key provisions. So what you see from the court generally is incrementalism, and then eventually leading to some dramatic moment. So I think it's unlikely to see a radical shift, certainly not immediately, but there's no doubt that there will be a shift to the right on this court, especially if you're looking at another 4 years of the current presidency, a Trump administration, and given the ages of the liberal justices. Those appointments, and they do make a difference.
I have to stop you there, Professor Guy, Charles Duke Center of Duke University Center of Law, Race, and Politics, Dr. Martha Ginn with Augusta University, and Dr. John Schmier with UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.